going with the last part of the discussion on black hole perturbations, and hopefully we're going to get to something that is fun to discuss. And other things that are, well, so, sort of fun, sort of practical, sort of quite relevant nowadays. I forgot to give you this reference. It's a rather recent reference on black hole perturbation theory by Karl Martel and Eric Poisson. It contains all the details that we're covering, and of course a lot more. Yesterday we mentioned that our perturbative approach kind of assigns some background. This background that we're talking about it at this moment is Schwarzschild, and then we have some perturbation, which is called P1, and I'm purposely not putting the subindices, they are understood. And then out of this P1, we recognize three cases, P, PA, and PAB, which had things that we were going to assign, had transform with respect to in ways as if it were scalar, vector, and tensors with respect to rotations on the sphere. And we're very familiar to describing scalars on the sphere in terms of spherical harmonics. And it would be convenient to have relative or related concepts that are especially adapted to vectors and tensors, and one can construct those. So we have vector spherical harmonics, which we have two of those, one with notation YLM, which is given by just the angular derivative of the YLM. And then we have something called an axial vector spherical harmonic, which they denoted with X, which is similar to this, except that now we're trying to make room or have a convenient entity to describe pseudo vectors. If we're talking about, say, the angular momentum, this has this. And this is epsilon AB is a Levi-Civita tensor associated with our sphere metric. Which let's call it omega AB. So depending on which coordinates you're using, omega AB might have different ways of being written. So this is a tensor, sorry, this is a vector, and this is an axial vector, which will flip signs if you do a mirror transformation, for instance. And also, one can define tensor spherical harmonics. And of those, we have, again, an axial tensor spherical harmonic or a tensor spherical harmonic under the definition. Well, let me now change the notation. I'm going to use LM up and AB here. And this is just PA dB of YLM, so the covariant derivative of our scalar spherical harmonic. And for convenience, this is useful to add. And then we have the axial tensor spherical harmonic. Yeah, so let me just move this here. And these objects are all orthonormal among themselves and across. So they are a very convenient way to capture the general structure that perturbations will have. And so then explicitly people use that, and they will write the following. And again, the details I wouldn't suggest you worry about writing them. They're all in the paper. Let's just try and see how the efforts that you have to invest to go through to something that ultimately one can then ask specific questions, and then we're going to discuss more in detail the answer to those questions. But the decomposition, remember we have this scalar pieces of the perturbations that refer to the TT, TR, and RR. Those are scalars, so we represent them as some component of some perturbation function, which we denote with AB to carry the indices and just a scalar spherical harmonics. We also have the vector part, where this is the index of the sphere. This is, say, theta and phi. And for that, we're going to use the vector spherical harmonics that we introduce. We could have things that transform as vectors and things that transform as pseudo-vectors. And similarly, now when we talk about with the tensorial part with respect to the sphere, one introduces this decomposition. And here we use our tensor spherical harmonics, the axial one, which is the X, and the non-axial one over there, the tensor here and there. And we also use the spherical harmonics when multiplied by the unit sphere metric. And then this is the general representation of a general tensor perturbation of the sphere component.
Luis, is that just symmetrizing AB? Because it seems both the terms.
Oh, sorry. Yes. That's what I meant. Thank you. Oops. Yeah. So up to now, we haven't done anything but set up the general composition. We have yet, remember, when we try and do a perturbation, but sooner or later, we need to specify coordinates. Some coordinate conditions. And there are many choices. A convenient choice has been used in many works. It's called the Reggie-Wheeler gauge. And that is to set, so we need to set four conditions. We have four coordinates that we can choose, and this particular gauge sets JA equal to 0. Remember, this A index only runs on T and R, so these are two. It sets PLM to 0, so that's just one. It looks like we have a lot more because we have LM, but it's a coordinate condition, and then we can project always on the LM sectors, and because we're working at the linear order, they don't mix. So this is just two conditions here, one condition here. We need one more, and that's to set this one to 0. So there is a condition on this side, that is multiplying the components that were even parity, i.e., they were not pseudo constructions. They did not involve the Levi-Civita tensor, and one that is on the odd parity. So that looks odd, but one of the things you can do in this case, having chosen this way, is to realize that every remaining component of the expansion can be encapsulated on two new variables, These are called. So out of these, I'm going back through the equations and massaging them enough. You can show that they are the perturbative equations reduced to two equations or two, what they are called, master variables. Given by phi, even phi odd, which can refer to how they change or how they relate to our basis that was constructed that way. The equation is very simple looking for these variables. So let me just give it to you. And then we'll discuss trying to solve them. So if we have a source, we would have the corresponding combination of the source that will give, again, something that transforms evenly once we do a transformation of our angular part. But more interesting is the structure that we're beginning to see here. This is the wave equation in spherical coordinates with some potential at some source. We're going to get to that in a second. So let me first give you what that phi even here is. I'm not going to spell the phi odd. The structure phi odd obeys is very much similar to the even one. In fact, it's a little bit simpler. But the characteristics of the equations that is governing both of them are very much the same. So I'm going to just give you this so that you can see how, if you obtain phi even and phi odd, then you can iterate and solve some very simple looking equations to obtain what we really wanted, which were the k, the h's, everything that goes into this expansion. And with that, we can construct our metric perturbation. And if we add it to the background, that we will say is a metric of the full spacetime. Again, I'm not being very careful here. I'll refer you to the explicit expressions there. But essentially, this gives you an illustration how these master variables are related to our perturbative quantities. And another thing that I drop here is the indices LM. So we have as many equations as the number of LMs we care to solve, where the linear order, we're using a basis that's completely orthogonal. So it's a collect. Our original equation can be decomposed in all the LMs independently. And again, because we are restricting so far to the first order, there is no mixing that we have to worry about. The interesting, more interesting feature is what is the shape of this potential. So V even and V odd, again, share very many similar features. So if I'm in units of, so in radius, in units of m, so this starts at 2. Remember, we use so far, or all the way through here, Schwarzschild coordinates. Schwarzschild coordinates go singular at r equal to m. We cannot go past them. So this is from 2 to infinity. I'm going to put a 3 here, this 3m. And then if we plot for, say, l equal 2, this shape is like so. L equals 3, shape is like so. L 4, and so on. So what we have is a scalar wave equation potentially with some source that sees a potential that has a bump at 3m, and then it decays away to infinity. So we have a perturbation that is far out here. Essentially, we describe outgoing waves. Some of those will be coming. It will hit this barrier. They will bounce. The ones that will have the most chance to interact with the strong gravitational potential or the potential of the black hole are the low Ls. And this is why they are the fundamental or most, they are referred as fundamental most, the ones you see playing the most relevance. And if you have seen, say, from LIGO pictures or whatever, when they show you this, usually what you're seeing is the L equal 2 mode. There are cases where they put all of them, but by and large, most cases are dominated by the L equal 2 mode, M equal 2 mode. Because there are configurations where there is sufficient mass ratio, et cetera, where other of the modes become quite relevant, but by and large, most is coming on the L equal 2 sector.
Why is that the case? Why L is equal to 2 dominates?
Why? This one has the weakest barrier. The other ones is bouncing off this potential and going to infinity, doesn't get to interact a lot.
But what about L is equal to 1?
Oh, good. We don't have L equal 1 for gravitational waves. So, but great question. So gravity, general relativity conserves momentum and center of mass. Conservation of center of mass says L equals 0, you're not going to be able to radiate. Conservation of momentum, you're not going to be able to radiate as a whole, and so this is why you start with L equal 2. Also, gravitational waves are quadrupolar in nature, so we start from L2 onward. But yes, thank you for that question. So this is an illustration of how this project is carried out to first order. But we're going to ask a few more questions. Let me just say a few more things that are relevant here. Work in the next order is highly complicated, and that next order will not only mix these components, but it will create its own source. And also, physically, you can imagine that Schwarzschild, I'm going to kind of backtrack on this statement in a bit, ever so slightly, but you can imagine that Schwarzschild should be an unstable black hole, because if it absorbs anything that has a little bit of angular momentum, Schwarzschild will cease to be Schwarzschild, will become Kerr. Right, so then that's a very obvious assumption. But if we assume that our perturbation never adds any angular momentum to the space-time, one of the things we would be very interested in knowing is where Schwarzschild is stable. We would like to know the solution, the general solution to this problem, and where it defines for us a problem that where phi decays and leaves back Schwarzschild. We're going to get there in a second, just describe some generalities and some shortcomings. They are not fully unearthed by this procedure, or by the procedure we'll talk. But so I'll just mention some comments for Kerr black holes. So if you try to go this route, just copy what we've done for Kerr black holes, you quickly reach a wall. And that wall is that this structure is not nice enough to allow you to completely detach all the perturbations. So here, every single perturbation, every single LM has been completely detached. So L equal 3 does not talk to L equal 20. If you, and you have few fully separable equations as a result. So we have that equation, and we can easily solve it by assuming phi is some function of r times some function of time. And the angles had already been kind of taken away by the appropriate projection on the LMs. That is not, that hasn't been shown to be possible using this strategy. A similar related strategy is to go, and this is the Tolkowski formalism. Again, that uses something known as the Newman-Penrose. Formalism, assuming the background is Kerr, and then using not so much from the get-go, the perturbation being that of the metric, but perturbation being given in terms of quantities that are obtained from the Biot scalar. And with that, then you can get to a separable equation. And this is why once you talk about rotating black holes, the Tikhotsky formalism is usually what people employ. But beyond that, again, this project in both cases has been carried out in full only to first order. Second order, not quite complete for a almost complete for a Schwarzschild case, and it's still more work. Quite a bit more work to be done on the rotating black hole case. So now let's discuss a little bit about the potential solutions we could have here. So one, and this is the most interesting in some sense, both as I said, because we want to go back to our original question, can we trust the Schwarzschild solution, the Kerr black hole, whichever one we care, to be representative of physics? If we perturb it, do we stay close to it? So one very common strategy to study this comes in the vein of what's referred to as quasi-normal modes of black holes. And the quasi-normal, this Q here is there because suppose you're trying to use to solve that equation. That equation is, as I said, it's a wave equation with a potential. We've done this many times. You've done it in quantum mechanics often. But usually that problem refers to the evolution of waves in a box that conserves energy. Our problem here is different. At infinity, this potential goes to zero. Waveforms go away. They are lost to radiation. And at the black hole, the waves go in, get absorbed by the black hole, and they're lost. So what we have here is a leaky box. A box that is losing energy at some given rate, given by the physics of the problem. So then you have to postulate how you're going to go about trying to solve or study that problem. So let's again, we're talking about Schwarzschild. So this is future null infinity. This is a singularity. This is the horizon. And at this order, the important thing is that we're never back reacting on the curvature. We have a metric that is varying because of our perturbation, but the source never knows that the black hole is changing its mass, that the space m is losing energy. It's the background mass of the black hole is always m. We are not changing it explicitly at this order. At higher order, this thing will start playing a role. So the physical picture that we have is, well, waveforms are going out, can go out and then be lost to infinity. Waves can go in, and or perturbations can fall into the black hole. And then eventually, one of the questions we want to ask is this true? I mean, is this going to a nice structure where what you have left is essentially Schwarzschild again, but closer and closer, or arbitrary and arbitrary closer to Schwarzschild as you go further and further to the future? So the first thing, we have an equation that is second order type. If we want to solve it, we need to provide two boundary conditions. So the boundary conditions we're going to consider natural would be as r goes to infinity. Well, let me start with the r one. As r goes to r plus or r of the black hole, we want stuff to be falling into the black hole. We would expect our perturbations to go like e to the I minus I omega t minus r. And I'm going to introduce a little bit further. Remember, t, t plus r. Remember, if it is t plus r, we discussed last week, the characteristics are moving to the left. So that's what we're saying here. This is something where things are moving to the left. And in practice, a lot quite convenient to do it with respect to r star. And r star is the tortoise coordinate. So if R goes from 2m to infinity, R tortoise goes from minus infinity to infinity. You just map it that way. So that's what you expect as a boundary condition closer to the horizon. But at infinity, now let's put R star. Sorry, this is R star going to minus infinity. If R goes to infinity, and R star is also going to infinity, you expect the solution to behave like e to the minus I omega t minus R star. So one warning as you read papers, different people choose slightly different conventions and take the minus, others take the plus. And so then what you ask is different properties, just flip the sign of omega. But just pictorially, if you think that the result of this exercise of perturbing the black hole ever so slightly is to obtain back Schwarzschild, we're assuming that you don't introduce any angular momentum with your perturbation. You expect that this omega, if we ignore R for a time being, this omega should be such that it has a, if omega is complex, the most general omega we can imagine, we want to have that omega be negative, this imaginary component. If that's the case, as we go to infinity, we'll have a exponentially decaying function. And that's what we're going to be set out to do, to try and solve where this is the case. We have to be especially careful when we say that, because if we have this being negative, as we take for a given time, as we take the limit to the horizon or infinity, we're going to hit this minus R, which is going to infinity. So this is actually blowing up. So it is true that it's decaying as we go to the future, going to I plus, but it's blowing up as we go to R equal infinity. So this is not seen or not regarded as the full solution. This will be a solution for some intermediate time, which would then will give rise to another phenomenology, which we understand what it is. But at least for some time, some region, say close to the black holes where we're perturbing, this is how we're going to understand the system. So that's the first observation, that Poisson modes can provide a full description. And again, the Poisson modes are defined to be the solution, say in this case, to the Masser equation under this condition. And you ask, what are the solutions, what are the modes that will be allowed under that assumption? You're going to get some solutions I'll describe in words, and then just schematically some of their features. But what you, just with that very simple argument, can deduce is cannot be a description. You also will find out that if you perturb in a description that has these LM modes, you're going to have solutions are labeled by L and M, and then I will add another parameter in a second, and you can prove that those solutions are not the basis. Again, this is related to this first point. These boundary conditions, just as in the case as a wave in a box told you that the omegas were quantized, these boundary conditions that describe a leaky box also imply a quantization of the omegas. The solutions are labeled by omega LM, by LM. They have description in terms of radial functions that depend on Lm. They have become associated to them omegas that depend on L and M. And what you find is that if you fix L and M, you have more than one solution. And the labeling of that more than one solution is called an overtone. So it's an R index of one odds. And you can find all these solutions. Of course, the equations are sufficiently complicated, are hard to solve in a straightforward manner. People have introduced yet another perturbative way of solving this problem through some reduced fraction method numerically, or even noticing that part of the problem, you cannot solve this in a straightforward manner, is that the potential, even though it's sufficiently simple, it's part of the complication. So by using potentials that approximate the true potential you have, you can make quite rapid progress and then find closed form solutions. So I'm not going to get into that. If you're interested, I can give you references. But let's just discuss a little bit of what is it that you find once you have those solutions. So one particular thing, let me just give you, suppose you fix L equal M equal 2. And we're thinking of N equals 0. I'll tell you one more thing about the N's, but let's think of the mode that is the most relevant, and I'll tell you why it is the most relevant for having fixed L and M to 2. What you find is that this omega, okay, so we have one scale in the program, in the problem, that's the mass of the black hole. So anything we do will have the units of the mass. So it's easier to then just write omega. We know this has units of 1 over length, and our only length variable is the mass. So it's quite useful to just express it in terms of mass times omega. Now we have a unit-free quantity. And this is 0.3785. I mean, it's not a big deal what this thing is, but it's important that it's order 1. So that's just one mode. I chose n equals 0, so let's just focus on the imaginary part. First thing first, it checks. We have a negative value. Any overtone, keeping the L and M fixed, if we are to look at n equal 1, 2, and higher, it will have this value getting more and more negative, which means it dies off more quickly. So it, after a little bit of a perturbation, it goes away, it becomes irrelevant far faster than this fundamental mode. The fact that it decays, okay, it confirms or it coincides with our hope that the solution would be this, or a stable black hole would be, will obey that this is decaying. And then any other L, higher L that we can consider, will also have that for the reasons we discussed before. Higher L's decay faster and faster. So eventually, this is the mode that will dominate for most cases. The other important thing is this thing is the real part. So the real part, if we go back to our answers for the solution, is how rapid this thing oscillates. It's oscillating with a scale that is commensurate with the mass of the black hole. It's order 1. So when you kick a black hole, say a Schwarzschild black hole, this will kind of oscillate, wobble, releasing its structure with a decay rate in the slowest case given by that. And it will reach quiescence. It will go back to Schwarzschild because I promise this, I'm not showing, but you promise if you solve for all perturbations, Lm and whatever n as well, all happen to be imaginary. So for the time where quasi-normal modes capture much of the description of the spacetime is relaxing to equilibrium back to a Schwarzschild black hole. The other neat thing is that if you were to measure, so the only in this case, Schwarzschild, in the case of Schwarzschild, let's say for simplicity, then we'll discuss a little bit about Kerr. The decay rate and the oscillation frequency depends on the mass. So if you measure one, you immediately know what the R should be. So if you go to a collision of black holes that happen to have zero angular momentum that is decaying, you're going to see, OK, maybe earlier on it's a mess. You still cannot rely on the background or the space-time to be sufficiently close to Schwarzschild. But let's imagine you wait a little bit, and now you're seeing this thing decay exponentially. So a measurement of the period will tell you about this one. Measure of the decay rate will tell you about that one. And you already have a prediction of what this should be. So if they don't agree, you already are perhaps getting a hint that generativity is incorrect, or that your assumption that this is a Schwarzschild black hole is incorrect. So in the case of Kerr black holes, what I said under these assumptions, though I'll discuss a little bit in a caveat in a second, under these assumptions for Kerr black holes, the Poisson modes also depend on L, M, and N, and are functions of mass and spin. So we have two parameters. But they have a real part and an imaginary part, which then means that if you have a detection of black holes coming from a space-time that you think has an angular momentum, or because you don't have any good argument, you're going to assume that it has some angular momentum, A different from zero. So if you get one mode, you have two pieces of information. Out of those, you can extract M and A. And then a measurement of another mode, either because it's a higher L, a different M, or a different N, will give you two extra pieces of information, and you're going to be able to contrast with that. So measurement of two modes gives you a great test of whether this is behaving like a black hole given by Kerr in generativity. And if you follow the literature, there is quite a bit of controversy going on nowadays on that. LIGO is seeing this, and then this piece, and there's quite a bit of back and forth, people saying, we are seeing a higher mode, and others one saying, careful, you may be overfitting. So this is something that is happening. But the idea of black hole spectroscopy is driving quite a bit of research, both at the practical level, contrasting events detected by LIGO, Virgo, and Kagra observatories, and also at the theoretical level, trying to see to what extent can you trust and when this approximation, and also building higher order perturbations to do a better job here. As you can imagine, there is a lot riding behind this. If you were to have evidence of a deviation from generativity, you have a big, very big claim. Either generativity is wrong, or you have an object that looks and feels like a black hole, but there is a little bit of a difference. And so then you're going to have to find out how you can build confidence to that or not. You have any questions on this?
Why do people feel confident about describing that post-merger situation as just perturbations around Schwarzschild?
Excellent. That's a great question. Right. This is where the discussion is nowadays. And part of the problem is we go back to here. They are not a basis, but if you include as many ends as you want, they can be overcomplete in some sense. You could start to fit a lot. And this is a fact. So let me just put, the fact is that the people that are pushing for this idea, if you include more in terms of overtones, you do a better fit. That is undeniable. The discussion is whether that implies the system is behaving linearly, and that's what the right interpretation should be. And the question you ask is the question that we're struggling with. I mean, we're fighting in the nicest possible terms, but this is what we're doing. So it is surprising. So I'll tell you, like you, so why would it start behaving linearly so early on? Because the other problem that people face at the practical level is you wait. So we would all agree that if you wait long enough, because these things are decaying, eventually you're gonna make contact with that. But there is another caveat that we have to discuss, but eventually you're gonna make contact. The problem is that as you wait long and long, your signal is getting weaker and weaker, and then you get swamped by the noise. So you're trying to push it as early as possible. And what people are seeing, and if you put more and more overtones, you can push it quite early, where there is no real sense of this having to have a description where you can assume a linear perturbation will be fine. But the fact that you're doing it, it's very tempting, given that you're doing a better fit to start thinking that way. And so there is a lot of back and forth, people making theoretical arguments to say, no, there are true nonlinearities here that are playing a role, or but then people are going back and forth. So this issue is not going to be settled anytime soon. It might not ever be settled because there is an ambiguity here. But just keep an eye if you're interested. There will be discussion. The other thing I wanted to say with a Kerr black hole. So let's recap a little bit and then I'll say a few more things. So first, if we look at the Schwarzschild black holes, we've seen that every single mode is decaying. Does that imply that Schwarzschild is stable? Well, first we have to say, careful. You better assume that you have introduced any angular momentum in your spacetime, because if you have, you're getting out of Schwarzschild. Good. Let's assume we don't have any angular momentum. Does that imply that Schwarzschild is stable? The answer is no, because again, what we have is mode by mode, things are decaying. But that's still not the same as saying the full perturbation, and given, especially in light of that the quasi-random modes are not capturing everything, we still are not sure that there might be a little corner where things are going to be unstable. But the good news is that it is stable. The Schwarzschild is stable under those assumptions. There is quite a bit of mathematical work that goes to completely fix all the potential issues, and that result is set. For Kerr black holes, it's not so clear. In fact, people have already identified an instability when you take A to the very extremal case. But there's another one that is a lot more fun. And if I go here, and you imagine that you're saying, I'm going to make any perturbation that I want. In fact, I could perturb when I have even a mass there. If I have a mass in the source, this changes my potential ever so slightly. It gives it another bump here, wherever the source is. That bump is enough to establish kind of a back and forth of a wave that goes, it's trying to go out, hits its other bump, comes back, interacts with the black hole, and does it again. And there's a phenomena called superradiance instability for the right modes that can extract a little bit of the angular momentum of the black hole. So there are modes that, if you study, it's not true that all modes will decay away. There are some modes that will grow at the expense of the angular momentum of the black hole. And once these grow enough, they take away sufficient angular momentum of the black hole, they decay again. But for transients, it's an interesting aspect, and this complicates getting the final result that Kerr should be stable. Yet it is very interesting that simulations of collision of black holes in very general conditions show that you collide these objects and you seem to be able to get always to Kerr at the end. And see, this backs some conjecture by Werner Israel or Penrose, and it's not clear who did it and who said, because each other assigns it to the other one, which is the conjecture that it says the end state of a collapsed situation is a Kerr black hole in general relativity. So that's, it's very interesting that we keep seeing that. And also that end state, reaching that end state is very soon. Very soon after the merger, you have something that's very highly perturbed in the case back to Kerr. But now I wanted to show you something fun, just to say, okay, we worked really hard, we got that. this need not always be the case. So let's go one dimension up. Think of higher dimensions. And this, you probably, did you guys take an early GR course with Ruth Gregory? Yeah, guys. So let's make a connection with that.
Just one comment on stability of curve. Means at least that much is concerned. Means it's the stability of curve is not like a situation with the hockey stick standing on its head, right? Means we know
at least that's instable.
We know that whatever is out there is something like curve. There could be small deviation, but there is something stable there, right?
Yes, but there. I mean, this instability. So as I said, it grows and then it saturates, and there is quite a bit of interesting work here led by Will Lees and collaborators, Tasha is also involved and others, where you actually can grow out of the energy of the black hole a cloud around the black hole. So now the black hole has some structure, has a quote unquote hair. Of course, this is in some scenarios that you may not regard as physical or maybe a bit creative. So but you could imagine if there is a scalar field out there with a given mass that you're going to use to try and explain dark matter, you can raise a cloud or grow a cloud around black holes through the interaction with that. So there's quite a bit. But yes, it doesn't completely disrupt things. But there are calculations so you can take away about 10% of the mass and some amount, comparable amount of angular momentum. So it could be quite a bit of stuff taken away from the black hole and put it in the same surrounding.
Sorry, yes? Just going back a bit, when you say that it might always be ambiguous whether you can fit these using just like the linear regime, if you can quantify the nonlinear effects, would that make it?
Yeah. Right. So, but then you're going to quantify, and so then you're going to say the reason I say it's ambiguous is that, like, in some sense, it will never be linear. It will be sufficiently linear given some sharp criteria that you're going to be happy to use the linearized approximation. Yeah, so that's, we need to come out with that. And then how sharp and how generic that statement will be, okay, that remains to be seen. Thank you. So did you discuss with Ruth the black string?
Yeah.
Did she tell you why the argument why you would expect an instability there? No? You remember? Okay, let me just give you some generalities and then we'll discuss a little bit of that part of those perturbations. So let's take phi dimensions. So this argument is general. So d equal phi. And now suppose you do the following exercise. Oh, as before that, let me just give you another thing. In d equal 4, there's a theorem by Kristen Slyke and collaborators on UBC. It says black hole topology is S2. If you have a black hole, it has to have that topology in four dimensions. That's no longer true the moment you go one dimension up. You can have D greater than 4. You can have S2 cross S1, let's say in D equal 5. You can have S3. That would be the analog of that. You have this one. You can have worse things yet, what I call black Saturns. You can have a torus this way and something embedded there. And then many torus. I mean, the number of options you have is ridiculously large. You also have no curve bound. Especially in D greater or equal to 6. It could be in D equal 5, it could be a bound, but it's very loose, very weak. But you don't have any bound on your angular momentum as you have in D equal 4. There in D equal 4, you know that if the angular momentum is too large of the black hole, you go into a naked singularity. So you could have black holes. The analog of a curved black hole, you can construct in a higher dimension, say D equal 6, and you can make it rotate arbitrarily fast. Without ever encountering singularity, what happens is that your spheres or spherical, spheroidal shape has more angular momentum. As you increase the angular momentum, kind of gets flattened and you go into something that looks more like a disk. But there is no bound on the angular momentum. So now, in some sense, uniqueness goes out of window. You can fix the mass say, in this example. And for this very same mass, you can have at least two black holes. So that lack of uniqueness prompts to the question, well, maybe at least many of them are unstable and want to go to the one that is stable, or the one that is the most stable under some condition. So there was this very nice work that Gregory and Laflamme did in the early 90s. Ruth might want me to take that away. So where they study these black holes and then ask what is the stability. In particular, they count the focus on the black hole that is cylindrical. And for the sake of the argument, let's take with d equal 5 versus, no, so one that has surface S3 versus an area that has topology S2 cross. Let me call it, I can do L, where L is the length of this string. And if you imagine that there is a compactification around that L, there's a periodicity associated with this extra dimension. So this is, they say this is the dimension Z. The other thing you can do is to compute the entropy, which of course we know is associated to the area divided by 4. But the entropy is area divided by 4 in Planck lengths, in Planck units. But the Planck length depends on the number of dimensions. So if you use that, the fact that say Newton's constant in 5 dimensions would be equal to the Newton's constant in 4 dimensions times the length of this extra dimension. And you ask the question, how does the scale of a black hole scale versus a scale of a black string? You have that for the case of a black hole. This goes like m over 3/2. And times L, or one, this goes like m squared. And this one could be divided by L, or this is multiplied by L, some power. So the idea is that if you put the same mass at sufficiently large, long extra dimension, the entropy of the black string becomes smaller than the entropy of the black hole. And there should be a way to go from here to there if it is the case that the space-time is trying to maximize the entropy. And it is the case that this is, there is no another solution that you haven't been able to construct where this thing would go. And in fact, this goes back to what we said at the very beginning of these two lectures, where many of the solutions we obtain, we know of, are very special. In order to be able to solve the equations, we impose symmetries, and those symmetries might just give us only a subset of the solutions, potential solutions to the problem. In fact, in the early 2000s, there was work by Weissman that showed that there are solutions, especially in dimensions even higher than this, that would describe a black string that is like so. So it's a deformed black string, it's stationary, but it has some structure. So there was a question of thinking, well, we have this black hole, we have the black string, we have the solution. Who knows, maybe you end up here or you end up there. Let's discuss that. There was a lot of work on the analytical front. And this showed that this guy has more entropy than that guy in dimensions larger than 12 or 13. So there was a lot of work on this. But the cutest thing, or one of the cutest things of the paper by Ruth Greger and Ray Laflamme, was to actually go and set up this perturbative approach. So you start with a metric, which is, you have two options. You have one where it's Schwarzschild plus dz squared, that's your extra dimension. That's the metric of the black string. The metric of the S3 black hole is the one you know, except that some things change ever so slightly. Let's say r plus over R square. So that would be that metric. And so what they did is they took this metric and go through a perturbative program to see how you would go about solving the equations of motion there. So again, you have to worry about exactly the same things. First, how do you write a perturbation? You'll do the same thing. See, it's the black string background plus some perturbation. Now you have things in T, R, Z, theta, and phi. To simplify your life, you can begin saying, I will not allow any perturbations in theta and phi. They actually did also study those, and they showed that they are all stable, those perturbations. The unstable perturbation comes when you perturb things along the Z direction. You also have to do the gauge fixing. And once you do go through that program, you end up with a particular equation of motion, which is kind of messy. You're looking for solutions of something called the Lichtenberg operator that is essentially your perturbation, which in this case, oh, sorry, it's about EAB. And again, you postulate or they postulated that this H can be written, and I'm using their notation in case you read their paper. They chose to use this one. So it's only perturbation along Z with a given wave number mu, or let me call it k. And here they choose the omega. And what you're trying to say is where you have solutions where omega is real. If you find solutions where omega is real, or has a real part that is positive, you're going to have a mode that grows. And that's precisely what they found. They found that for different dimensions, we have a behavior, so I go like this. This would be for higher dimensions, etc. And this is in units of mass, 0.4, 0.6, somewhere in between. What it tells you is that there was a mu goes like 1 over the length. So mu, sorry, k. A goes like 1 over length. So if we go to this limit, that's an infinite string.
What are we plotting on the y-axis?
Sorry, this is omega. My bad. So that says that for very, very long strings, there was an instability. And as you go smaller and smaller and smaller, at some point, it becomes stable again. This point here is quite reasonably approximating by asking when is a black hole entropy larger or equal to the black string entropy is of the right order.
And this one is like, this is d is equal to 4, d is equal
yes.
to 5, d is equal
to 6. So this is d equal 4 plus 1, 5 plus 1, etc. Or 4 plus, let me do 4 plus 2, 4 plus 3. Oh, no, let me just do it away. So you have only one extra dimension in the Z, and the rest you pack in the angular direction. 4 plus 1, 5 plus 1, etc. So two cute things. So now you know that black holes will have that instability. What's the end state of that instability? Because what this does is it takes this string with a small perturbation into like so. So it just shrinks about it some places and makes it larger in other places. one question here was, so what happened with this neck? So there is, will be a piece where it gets small. Is it the case that this is sufficiently small and sufficiently large for it to undergo another one of instability? For that, of course, provided this space-time here, and this goes back to your question, Jaime. If this space-time here, where it formed this little neck here, is sufficiently close to a black string, and this is sufficiently long and short, I mean, this ratio is the one that matters, mass over length. If this is sufficiently within this regime for an instability to take place, so maybe the next step is to go into something that goes. I don't know, you can probably see what I'm trying to draw here. I'm not right, where you undergo a second instability. And then you go again. If this thing is sufficiently close to another black string, this could go on. And yeah, in the year 2015, this is what was shown. This indeed happens. And it happens in a very interesting way. The time where this progresses gets shorter and shorter, because essentially the unit of time is given by the unit of mass, but the cross-sectional mass of something that's thin is very small, and it's getting exponentially smaller. And so this will have pieces that will shrink to zero size. So you will reveal a naked singularity in finite time. So this was an example of violation of cosmic censorship in higher dimensions.
So here, the perturbation we did was around S3.
No, the perturbation is not around. So here is, you're going, so this is, you start here. You make a perturbation around Z. And you're asking the question, this was a black string that was perturbed. Are you going to land here somehow?
Yeah, okay.
So how would you land here? So eventually I told you that the simulations were not able to go all the way through, but imagine that at some point this shrinks enough that you cut it off and you reveal a naked singularity. Because now we have to hope for the best, and God will probably say, eventually quantum gravity will fix this, will regularize the solution there, will cut this off, right? And then we may end up with a big black hole, a small black hole, and our big black hole in the sequence of those things. Then they will attract each other, they will merge and form a single one, and this is how you will go here.
Sorry.
That's okay. So this is how you would connect dynamically from this into that. And we may have, now remember we said, as you go into higher dimensions, uniqueness of black holes go out the window. Unless you maybe ask for another condition. You want the black hole, a solution that is both a black hole, but that black hole is stable. And maybe it is the case that if you add stability to your condition, you recover uniqueness of black holes in higher dimensions. That we don't know. The other interesting thing is the connections of this problem with other things. I'll mention these two and then we'll wrap up. One fun, and both of them are quite fun. So the first one is, remember I told you...
Sorry.
Yes.
I missed that part. How would you get those three black holes separately?
Oh, this black hole. So, let me see. How this black hole form or behave afterwards?
No, before forming this tree, from that part to another, yeah.
Right. So suppose. Okay. So let me first comment. Make the comment that I was going to make, and then we can connect with that. Think of a soap bubble. So take a soap bubble. I mean, just with two whatever pieces of wire, and now begin to stretch it. So your bubble. In fact, I have a video people having done with that with saliva. So the. It's kind of gross, but you can do that. So you do this, and then you have the soap bubble. So it's that, right? So the soap surface. You begin to pull it, and then at some point, what you have is this one. It's so close, and then it breaks here, and now it generates this bubble and that bubble, right? Okay, up to this point, before the breaking point, before some small scale, you could use the fluid dynamical equations to study what is going on. At some point, when it gets so small that it's kind of commensurate with the molecular distance scale, well, fluid dynamics is no longer applicable. just one has to study molecular dynamics or something to resolve that. This would be the akin, or the analog, quantum gravity will come and have to save the day. But something that was not a priori clear, I mean, from the equations of motion, you went from fluid dynamics to a place where molecular dynamics took over. Why it wasn't necessarily clear that after that you go back to fluid dynamics with exactly the same equations you started with, right? And then you can keep describing these bubbles. So that thing is what I was saying. So you could do, you shrink, and at some point you shrink enough that you're going to, as I said, in finite time you reveal a naked singularity. We don't know what to do when the naked singularity forms. But it may be, the only thing I can tell you is that's a naked singularity with zero mass. So the curvature is going to infinity, but the mass is going to zero. So it could be that now this thing severs itself. At that point, we cease to have control on the theory because the curvature is infinity. So some other theory has to come and replace and tells us what is going to happen. If it so happens that what it left behind is, again, general relativity to describe these things, and it's, you're going to go back to the bubbles, and then you're going to form that black hole, small, different size black holes. And from there on, it's again classical general relativity merging these two black holes and giving rise to this final one. So that was the one comment I was going to make. The other one is, remember I said that in five dimensions, you could have this black hole that doesn't have a bound on the curve, on the how rapid it can rotate. And if it is very, very rapid, then you generate something that's more like a pancake. Well, in a very interesting work by Roberto Imparam and Rob Myers, they realized that there is some region here in the spacetime that has a black hole that is extremely flat, where the metric can be arbitrarily well approximated by the black string. And once you say you buy that, if this is true, and this is what they show, then you buy everything that comes afterwards that you're going to break. And then indeed, people have shown, this is work by Paul Figuera and collaborators, that if you take one of these black holes that are very rapidly rotating at some speed, you're going to start breaking it off. Which again goes back to the comment I said. So maybe, so we know that in four dimensions we have a bound for curved black hole and we have a uniqueness of black hole. In higher dimension, that goes away. But if you impose some extra conditions, in particular stability, you might end up with a unique black hole that does have a bound on the angular momentum. So this is just an illustration of the moment we abandon four dimensions, we get into a whole different zoo of options. Any questions? If not, I'll stop here. I think this is. But I would suggest that you might want to read the paper by Gregor and Laflamme. It's pretty fun. And also they have some reviews that are, I think, cleaner written. And this one, this is the paper by Imparam and Rob Myers. In addition of the paper is beautiful, they have a couple, the best two subsection titles I've ever seen in a paper. So they are trying to say what could happen with this object. And they have two sections, death by deflagration, which is what we just described, where this object begins to break itself apart, or death by radiation, because now if this is not breaking, but it has some non-trivial structure, it's rotating so fast that it begins to radiate angular momentum like crazy. And so it can reduce its angular momentum. So they discuss these two options. We now know that the generic option for very high one is going to be the breakup, but these simulations also show that if it's not rotating that fast, it reduces angular momentum by radiation. Okay, thank you.